You're listening to 66.6 FM, Radio TOVH, The Flush.
Scavies and gentlemen, boils and ghouls, fiends from beyond the binary, you're listening to the special October Spooktacular series here on the Toilet of Hell Radio Show. Each week this month we'll be joined by a guest to discuss some of the wildest horror movies around. I am Joe Thrash and Kill, and with me I'm joined by a very special guest. That's right, I'm not going to introduce Jordan or Brennoside. You know those people, you've heard enough from them. Get them the fuck out of here. No, instead, my very special guest today is host of the Merry-Go-Round Table podcast of the Merry-Go-Round magazine in LA. We have Carter Moon. How's it going, Carter?
Doing just fine. I'm very excited for this.
Yeah, we have a particular focus on this episode,
and yeah.
I figure, you know, folks, if you haven't seen this movie, we're going to discuss it in depth. So if you want to hit pause and watch a 20-year-old movie, we can go ahead and do that. But
it's one of those movies that like you really can't say anything about what makes it so interesting and makes it so great. Unless you just spoil the movie. The only way to talk about it is to kind of spoil it, and that's the whole point of what makes it so special. It's a thrilling fucking movie, and I think pretty much any metalhead would love Audition. So, it's worth watching if you haven't.
Precisely. I figure that also we should go ahead and probably put in some kind of content advisory. That a lot of the things that we'll discuss on this movie are deeply disturbing, by design, of course.
Yeah.
Audition, the 1999 opus of incredibly prolific Japanese filmmaker Takashi Miike. If that name is familiar to you, perhaps you're thinking of his most famous work might be Ichi the Killer.
Mm-hmm.
Or one of literally 100 other movies that he's done.
Yeah.
I think my favorite of the bunch is I had a weekend in college where I sat down and I just watched a whole bunch in one go.
Oh, wow. That's awesome.
I think my favorite was The Happiness of the Katakuris. Have you seen that one?
No, I haven't. So many people have recommended that to me over the years. And like after seeing Audition, I really wanted to seek it out and I just haven't gotten around to it yet.
It's funny because it is so entirely tonally different from everything on display with Audition, and it's very funny and lighthearted, and also it becomes a claymation movie at one point.
Right, people have told me about that, and it seems like so perfect because like Miike just like has this brain that just works like unlike any other filmmaker, and he's just so I think like endlessly creative and able to like turn things on a dime, as we'll get into with Audition. And like something like the full title of the movie is Happiness of
the Katakuris.
Yeah, like something like that has just always seemed really appealing. And like he's Miike in general is just somebody who like he's been on my radar for a long time, and I've barely scratched the surface of his movies. But I fucking adore Audition, and I'm really excited to talk about it in depth because it's unlike any other horror movie I've ever seen.
Before we delve into the film, I figure what we got to do is we should probably grill you a little bit. You're new around here. We need to establish your heavy metal bona fides.
Yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit about your history with the genre?
Yeah. So my history with metal is kind of funny, actually. I kind of really teetered between being into punk rock and into heavy metal when I was a teenager. And I kind of ended up leaning more towards punk for most of like high school, but you know, routinely like would just get into these benders where like the only music that made sense was Slayer and Pantera, and shit like that. And just like, you know, the aggressiveness and the directness of metal has always been really fun to me. And I always had like a ton of metalhead friends growing up. But for some reason, what happened to me actually in college was like I hosted a radio show with somebody who was a diehard metalhead. And so just over the years of hosting the show with him, I got more and more into metal, and he introduced me to stuff like Sun and Earth and Boris, the really heavy stuff. And also eventually like started delving more into like trying to find the like non-problematic black metal. And,
good luck.
Yeah. And once I sort of like crossed the threshold into really accepting, like listening to all types of black metal, and I indulged in some of the more problematic Nazi shit in bits and pieces in college to at least get familiar with the genre. But yeah, now like most of what I listen to most days is heavy metal, just to like get through the day and keep my eyes open. I need the aggression and directness of metal to keep me pumped and alive. I would say I'm wearing a Tomb Mold t-shirt right now.
Hell yes.
Planetary Clairvoyance is, I think, probably my favorite record from this year. It's been a long and weird journey to get so into this genre, but now that I'm fully immersed, there's no turning back.
That's the problem with all of this, is that you go down a hole and you can't get back out, unfortunately.
Yeah, it is. It's absolutely true, where it's just like, you know, like, why would I listen to nice music when I could destroy my ears with blast beats? Like, why, like, you could listen to like normal pop music, or like you could listen to music that sounds like it's churned out of the pits of hell. And like, it's more exciting to find the music that sounds like it's coming from hell at the end of the day.
And as you were establishing before we hit record, there really is just an unbreakable bond between heavy metal and horror in that way.
Oh, yeah.
And that, yeah. Some people, they might be satisfied to see, I don't know, Scream or Halloween. And then other people, they just activate some dumb switch in their mind.
Yeah.
And you're watching every student film on Shudder.
Yeah. And, you know, it's funny. I went to film school, and my relationship with heavy metal, with horror movies, is actually pretty similar to my relationship with metal, where, like, when I was in high school and like started film school, I kind of tried to be like, well, you know, I really liked horror movies when I was a teen, but like I need to put those behind me. I need to be like a serious film student. I need to watch like the art films and everything like that. And then like, you know, I start going through film school and I start realizing like, oh my God, like so many of like the old classic movies that were like the start of people being excited about what movies can be, those were horror movies. Like, German Expressionism is horror movies, and like the Universal Monster movies were the foundation of so much of what we now think of as blockbuster movies. Like, no matter how you slice it, like horror has always been like a key part of what makes movies vital. And I just sort of realized that like I shouldn't deny myself these movies that make me really happy and that make me really excited about movies. And it's the exact same thing with heavy metal, where, you know, I tried to act like I was too cool for it at one point, tried to sort of grow out of it. And then I just realized, no, there's no fucking point in doing that. Like, embrace the things that make you happy, full-throatedly enjoy them. Don't deny that you love them, and you'll be a much happier person as a result.
Absolutely.
You know, and it's a funny thing, because I've been going to Beyond Fest here in LA, which is like a festival sort of devoted to like weird and extreme movies. I saw the movie Parasite there the other night.
I really, really want to see that. I saw you, and I guess, yeah. I should go ahead and say that we became acquainted with each other through probably the best movie discussion group on Facebook.
It's that group fucking rules, and I'm so glad that we have it. And Parasite is a special movie. Maybe we could talk about it a little bit at the end, because it's a horror. It's another like horror movie unlike any horror I've ever seen before. But anyway, the point I was going to make is that Beyond Fest is, it attracts like the exact same type of freak that I am. The same type of people who love like extreme horror and extreme heavy metal. There were just so many like scrawny white dudes in black metal t-shirts at this festival. And it's been so funny to sort of like find my tribe and really see them in Hollywood and everything lately. Because yeah, I think if you're the kind of person who likes extreme media, if you're the kind of person who likes just like exposing yourself to the most intense things you can possibly find, those things are horror movies and heavy metal. And it's funny how like I always sort of like start to feel like you know, oh, maybe I'm not intense enough into these things. Maybe I'm not enough of a real fan. But like, I also feel like when I meet the right kind of people who are really into these things, we instantly bond and we instantly connect. Because like, if you like to put yourself through bad experiences, you have to be a certain type of person. And there's just an instant camaraderie that I think comes around being into punishing yourself with music and movies.
I think there's also like a chasm that I'm unwilling to approach with all of this, which is with extreme music, like going full into like power electronics and harsh noise.
Yeah.
And with film, like, I don't know, I'm thinking Mermaid in a Manhole, like all of the basically fake snuff films that come out of Japan circa 1988.
Sure. Yeah, it's you know, you've got to have a certain amount of darkness just hovering around you to be drawn to this stuff. And it feels good to like find other freaks and weirdos who are also drawn to the darkness and everything in a real way. And yeah, it's just, you know, and it's the thing of like when you can get through a really like punishing and crazy technical death record, or you can get to just like a punishing and horrifying movie and you come out on the other side, it really is that like roller coaster feeling of like, oh, we made it, we did it, we like conquered that thing. And yeah, it's just so satisfying. And it's always so great to meet other people who share that feeling.
I think that that particular feeling that you're describing is especially applicable for audition.
Yeah.
I first saw this back in college, and I rewatched it for the first time about a month ago with my wife. She had never seen it before.
Mm.
And I tried to not tell her anything about it, because I think this movie works best if you go in completely dead and you just don't know what to expect.
Yeah.
So she was definitely blown away with this one. Likewise, my regular co-host, 365 Days of Horror, or Jordan, he calls himself 365 Days of Horror because he ran a blog forever ago where he watched a horror movie every single day for a year and then reviewed them all.
Yeah,
but he had to leave town this week, but he was also like, dude, I'm not watching Audition.
That's so funny. Yeah, he just couldn't do it again, kind of thing.
I don't think he's seen this one, but there is a strain of horror movie. And in Audition, I think, was kind of the linchpin that influenced a wave of American horror movies in the early to mid-2000s.
Yeah.
We're talking about the so-called torture porn film series. Things like Hostel or Saw. Definitely took direct inspiration from Audition. Now, I think that we should probably note that Audition is a fair bit less, I don't know what the word is, it's more tasteful than those.
Yeah, well, the thing about Audition is that like there are moments of extreme terror that come up throughout it. Like there's a lot of really shocking imagery throughout it, but the climax is really the only point where you watch torture happen. And I think the whole movie is more effective because of that. I think like, because it takes the entire movie to lead up to the ultimate moment of just pure like annihilation. You really feel like you've earned it by the time you get to it. And it's, you know, impossible to look away because Mike has taken you so effectively down this like insane labyrinth to get to that point. I
agree with that, and it's also, I would say that there is more of a, I don't know if the message is the right word, but there's a lot more of a critique of specifically gender roles and Japanese society.
Yeah, it's the thing about Audition that makes it such a delight on top of being so horrifying, and you know, my favorite horror movies deal with basically three things, I think, in a nutshell. They have elements of intense humor, despite being very terrifying. They have moments of like real dread-inducing horror, like you know, shocking moments that you can't forget. And then finally, they deal in some way with gender and sexuality. Like, I think horror, more than any other genre, can really dig at, you know, gender roles and why we do things the way we do them, and the underlying sort of terrifying nature of, you know, either being male or being female, and the sexual dynamics that come along with that. And Audition just like ticks off all three of those categories for me so perfectly, because it's, for the first half of this movie, it's a fucking romantic comedy. And that's what's so just like absolutely batshit about it when you like watch it for the first time and you realize that like, oh, this is straight up like this could be a movie starring Meg Ryan and Tom Hanks for the first like, 45 minutes. And that's unbelievable that he's able, that Mika is able to like twist it and twist it and twist it until it becomes this absolute nightmare. But it starts out as this like meet cute bullshit that is just like to take like something so like seemingly sweet and innocent and warp it makes you question so much about what we think romance is, what we think like you know, dating can be and what's acceptable in dating culture and all this stuff.
I agree. And I think seen from a lens of 2019, wherein there has been a huge kind of awakening within media about how deeply embedded sexism is in our in all media and in society itself, that this is a, it's very much a, as you said, a premise for a 90s rom-com that would definitely be unacceptable nowadays as well.
You know, the thing, if I can just say why I think this movie especially just like punched me in the gut when I saw it for the first time earlier this year is that I work in casting and I work for a casting company where we put out casting notices for all types of projects. And a lot of them are like pretty unscrupulous, low budget things. And the main point of my job is to review the casting notices and try to screen casting directors to make sure that they're not up to shady bullshit. And so I just know in my gut that so much of like an audition process can be like a very vulnerable thing where people get up to all kinds of shady bullshit. And to see a movie about explicitly that, about like these, you know, kind of scummy middle-aged men using audition as a way to try to lure in a hot young woman to trick her into becoming a widower's girlfriend is it just it hits so hard because I just like, I see like these delusional freaks come through my desk like every single week who are trying to do not exactly what's going on in audition, but something pretty close to it. Like for instance, there was one time where a guy was trying to pay models to let him film them giving him horseback rides around a park. And that was what he really wanted to do. And he was, you know, he was positioning himself as a very professional photographer who was going to do this whole photo shoot around this and everything. And
are you sure this wasn't Harmony Korine?
I'm not positive. It really could have been Harmony Korine under an alias or like working with somebody else, because that does sound like something Harmony Korine would have done back in the day, at least. but yeah, just like knowing that there are so many in the entertainment industry, there are so many creeps who like really do want to use, you know, the casting couch for what it is and everything, and who like really do want to like take advantage of like people when they're at their most vulnerable, when they're, you know, auditioning for a part. It just makes this whole premise, even though this movie becomes kind of absurd and over the top and ridiculous, the premise to me just feels so real at the beginning, where like I could see somebody trying to pull off something like this, of you know, trying to stage an audition to find a girlfriend.
Yeah, and I guess that we should go ahead and talk about the entire premise of this movie is that my pronunciations are awful.
Yeah, no, I literally like I was looking over the Wikipedia and reading some other stuff about this movie, and I was like, I'm gonna butcher all of the names of these characters.
So I believe that Shigeru Aoyama, yeah. Is that right? Okay, that is our widower, as you mentioned. At the beginning of the film, you see a heartrending scene in which his beloved wife dies, and his years later, his now teenage son urges him to consider remarrying because all he does is basically work and smoke cigarettes while working. Right. Which leads to him and his good buddy that work at the they're basically both producers, is that correct?
Yeah, something with like making videotapes, making like sort of, you know, it's the VHS boom, and they're both in the process of like mass producing VHSs is sort of the sense that I get.
Yeah. I you know, it wasn't even that long ago, but I enjoyed looking at the now vintage technology that they were using to cast everyone. So over, I'm going to guess, a dozen or so drinks, his friend cooks up the plan. You know, let's find you a wife, a nice, pretty young wife, by basically auditioning a bunch of women for a soap opera role that will never, ever happen.
Yes. And like I say, as somebody who's worked in casting, that is such a, like, deeply scummy thing to do. Like, every single audition that actors go out for, they are desperate to get the job so that they can pay their rent for the month. Like, especially if you're doing any kind of like non-union or low budget stuff, like, those are people who like desperately need this opportunity one way or another. And to like have this whole thing that you cook up that is like entirely fake and will never lead to anything is deeply exploitative. And it's a thing that like Hollywood producer types just would think nothing of.
Yeah. And in the actual process, you know, you have all of these incredibly eager young actresses in, while the pair of men probe them with incredibly personal questions that have no place in any kind of working relationship.
Yeah, it's very apparent that this isn't a traditional audition at all, but they, you know, don't really care, and they don't seem to be worried at all that you know, any of these actresses are gonna realize what's going on. And yeah, eventually they find the one. They find the woman that he falls in love with and decides he's gonna pursue.
Yes, through the entire audition process, they find the young Asami, who is very quiet and demure and doesn't seem to have any outstanding qualities, like maybe some of the other people that he had interviewed. But I guess our man Aoyama was like, I guess he was like, well, she'll be an obedient wife.
Yeah, no, that is very much the subtext. He never has to say it out loud, but very much it's like, okay, this is a mysterious, quiet woman who will, like, I can project whatever I want onto her, and I can expect that she'll do whatever I want. You know, this whole process is about like them lying and manipulating, and she seems to be a person who will be especially malleable.
Yes.
So he thinks he's going to be able to. It's funny because the whole movie, it's very clear that like he doesn't think of himself as taking advantage of her, but it's very apparent in 2019, at least, that that's exactly what he's doing, is that he is trying to take advantage of this young woman.
Definitely. And I know that I couldn't tell you about current standards, but Japan also has an incredibly, or did have, a very patriarchal society. So this seemed to be like, yes, of course I will do this. That makes sense.
Right.
In his interview with Asami, she reveals that she wanted to be a dancer, but she injured her hip pretty badly, so she was unable to pursue that dream. And in the realization that she could no longer pursue that dream, felt like she had died.
Right. Yeah. She's. It's actually like, it's incredibly depressing what she says. Like what she reveals is deeply tragic. But in the careful framing of that scene, I just think that scene is so well shot and so well edited. They like make it very clear that like Aoma like identifies with her personal tragedy, that, you know, he sees his tragedy of losing his wife as equivalent to her tragedy of losing her passion of being a dancer, and that like on that level they will bond and be connected. And so he begins a relationship with her and begins taking her out on dates, and in that process, you know, as they try to track down references for her that she left on a resume, they start to find that those references don't actually check out, and that she may have lied about many of the things on her resume. But Aoma, you know, conveniently brushes that to the side and ignores it for the sake of pursuing love in his mind. And yeah, the movie sort of spirals out from there in a way that I just adore.
I'd say at this point, we're probably about 40 minutes into the film, if not a little bit longer. when he decides, despite the fact that he couldn't get a hold of any of these references and that, you know, some of these people that he was trying to contact have mysteriously gone missing.
Yeah.
He brushes it aside and decides to give Asami a call, which gives us a truly unique and horrifying scene.
Yeah. Every scene in her apartment is like some of the best stuff in the movie. Like, it just is like, it's the perfect example of like, you never actually know what a person is like in their private life. You never really, until you see it, until you actually can see it for yourself, like, you don't know what's going on behind closed doors. And in her like horrifying empty apartment, there appears to be nothing but a phone and a sack with a human body in it. And her sitting by the phone.
her neck just draped so low, very much like The Ring, essentially.
Yes.
Her face entirely obscured by hair. And as the phone goes off, she slowly lifts her head and gives the most sinister smile.
Yes. And this is the first time in the movie that you really get a sense of like the danger that's just around the corner, and that you really are given a sense of like how bad things are eventually going to go. But it's the first time where this sort of like sheen of this, you know, nice romantic comedy starts to fall away, and you start to see cracks in it and everything. And it's a brilliant reveal. It's such a great way to like twist a movie. I just think like, you know, nothing against horror movies that deal in very traditional tropes and deal in very traditional like narrative structure, but Jesus Christ, the way that this movie just sort of like makes you feel like nothing is safe and like you can't ever really know what's going to happen when you meet a new person, it's deeply unsettling, and it's deeply satisfying at the same time.
Definitely, you know. Normally, if you want to meet a new person, you know, you might roll the dice, go over to their place and find, you know, a series of anime wall scrolls or something other,
yeah,
you know, horrifying detail.
Yeah.
But in this case, you know, you might find a mangled body in a sack. Be careful out there, folks. You don't know who you're dealing with.
Well, and this starts to get at exactly what I think makes Audition so fucking cool, is that like, you know, I am currently single in LA, and that means I am on the dating apps, and it's a nightmare. And on OkCupid, I've now encountered multiple women who their screen name on OkCupid is just, please don't murder me. It's some variation on that. And it's like, truth be told, that's a thing. It's just like, in reality, like, women still just have a high expectation of being murdered by their domestic partner. And like, that's just an accepted reality for women. But on the reverse, men very rarely experience the idea that like they could start a relationship with someone and it could turn sour to the point of murder. And I think this movie flips that gender dynamic that exists. Doesn't matter if you're in Japan, the United States, or Spain, like that dynamic of men killing the women that they love is so common. And, you know, As this movie sort of shows, like, flipping and reversing that takes a lot. And to swap that gender role takes a person with, like, very unique forms of trauma to really achieve. And that's where this movie really, like, ratchets it up and becomes, like, truly a fascinating, like, exploration of gender roles.
Indeed. We have the character of Asami, you know, a hackier filmmaker might have just decided she's a murder monster for no reason.
Right. Yeah. Well, and like so much of the time when we talk about serial killers and when people sort of like make movies about serial killers, there's very little attention given to the why of, you know, why people commit serial murder and everything. And this film does such a like elegant and terrifying job of taking you deeper and deeper into Asami's history so that you come to understand why she is the monster that we eventually discover that she is. And it pathologizes her in a way that is all the more terrifying, because you realize that there's been a series of men who have abused her throughout her life. And, you know, Aoma like didn't have any context for that, but he also didn't take the time to consider that maybe the pain that Asami was feeling was even more real than his own, and that he Absolutely. Needed to consider to see her as herself, as a you know, deeply damaged and broken person, rather than this projection of an obedient wife that he was hoping she could be. And that really is his downfall in the movie, is that we watch as he starts to go on these dates with her, and he initially sort of like reads into the things that she says in such a way where he doesn't pick up on the warning signs that she is in fact this like psychopathic killer. And it's because he's sort of blinded, not exactly by love, but he's more blinded by the traditional ideas of romance that we let dominate so much of our culture and so much of our thinking about dating.
Absolutely. So it really doesn't take long. You know, you have these vignettes of, to be quite honest, painful dates. I would consider them awful.
Yeah. So that's the other thing that's so funny, is that like when you're objectively sitting outside of the conversations they're having, like they look like miserable dates. They look like the worst experiences in the world, but you just sort of like, it's, I do feel for Aoma as he's like falling for this woman, because it's like he's been lonely for so long and he hasn't had any sort of like romantic attention for so long that he's just, you know, completely wrapped up in these good feelings for the first time. And like, if you've ever been a sad, lonely man, like, you know what that feels like. You know how intoxicating it can feel to fall in love with the idea of another person. And so you just sort of watch him do this while knowing all along that he's going down a path of doom.
Yes. So the path of doom culminates in Aoyama inviting Asami to a beach resort with him for several days. Mm-hmm. This would be the first time that they would essentially be staying in the same room together, mm-hmm. which is a big step in a relationship, fellas.
Right.
And after, you know, these handful of awkward dates, he decides that at this place, at this time, that, you know what, I'm done with this whole seeking process. I found someone that works for me. I'm going to go ahead and ask Asami to marry me.
And it's one of those things where, like, a different movie, it would be really annoying that, like, oh, this guy's been on 5 mediocre dates and he's proposing marriage already. He's decided he's in love. But in the context of this story, it, like, perfectly makes sense that this guy would think like he's found the one and he's ready to commit to a new marriage and everything.
I mean,
like,
he had a damn audition process. That exactly, should be enough, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. He, you know, the, all of those auditions in a sense were dates. In a sense, he was like going through, you know, all of the attractive single women in Japan in a sense. And so he thinks he's, you know, lucked out and found the one in a million and all that stuff. And he's just completely blind. It's very interesting because, you know, he gets hints in that scene where he takes her to the hotel that, you know, her trauma and her past experiences may be even more intense than he realized. He finds burn scars on her body. As they, have sex for the first time, she demands that Aoma love him and love her and her alone. And you know, in the heat of the moment, he agrees to that, and that ends up being a key part of his downfall, as well.
Yeah, you know, that's especially if you've got like, you know, a child, that's a deal breaker, fellas. You gotta.
Yeah. He's got a 17-year-old boy. He's got to raise. He's still got, you know, somebody else in his life who matters, and everything. I think it's such an important scene because it's like, it's all about how like our notions of what romantic love is, and that romantic love should be this like all consuming across like all of our all time, like a forever permanent thing where, you know, love like transcends everything. That like, notion is ridiculous. It's absurd to think that like people can love each other forever and be partnered forever. But that's all Asami wants, is somebody to, you know, love her completely. And in, as we watch in her mind, like that obsession, and that desire for something that can never be attained is what pushes her to commit the horrific act of violence that concludes the movie. But yeah, I think it's important to also go into a little bit of what leads up to Aoma being attacked by Asami, where he comes this back.
This is like where the movie really starts to just go insane.
This is the point where the movie really turns into just like pure nightmare logic, and it's so like perfectly done. Like there's a lot of movies that will kind of slip into, you know, nightmare reality, and it'll feel very clunky and weird, and like the things that don't line up and don't make sense will feel like, you know, things that are being conveniently brushed over. In this, like with everything that Aoma starts to uncover, things become more clear and more terrifying. And even though like it's almost impossible to accept the reality of what's happened to Asami, it all makes sense. It all sort of lines up in everything else that she's sort of hinted at and told us throughout the movie. So he begins to dig up her past and some of the references that had seemed to be impossible to find on her resume. And that leads to discovering a trail of just mutilation and murder, basically.
Hell yeah. One of the contacts he's able to track down is her old dance studio. Mm-hmm. And this is just one of those iconic scenes in yeah. horror, where he finds a man in the corner playing piano, and upon looking closer at him, you find just this deranged, sinister man that has basically blocks for feet.
Yeah, his feet have been cut off and reattached. I can't remember like exactly what it is. It's such a like weird image. Is it that they like he's had new feet attached? What is it exactly?
It looks like, yeah, it was a crude prosthetic.
Yes.
After losing them feats.
Yes. And we also discover that he's the person who had been torturing Asami and burning her, right? And he was her abusive dance instructor when she was a very young child.
There's some super hard to watch flashbacks to basically this man entirely intact burning a little girl. It's yes. It's entirely fucked up.
And again, this is one of these things where, like, you know, a less intense movie, a movie that wasn't as interested in like really digging at these things, wouldn't show you something like that, and it wouldn't necessarily give a psychopathic killer a backstory like this, where like they show you like, oh yes, this is the result of horrific, unexcusable abuse. Like, this is not like something that's just irrational and happens for no reason. Like, this is a chain of like really horrific events that happened to this girl at a very young age, and now she seems to be pretty committed to getting her vengeance, as we see with the guy in the wheelchair with the fucked up feet.
After the dance studio, he checks out the bar she worked at briefly, mm-hmm. and finds that it's been shut down following the brutal murder of the guy yeah. who owned it.
Yeah, and the best detail about it that just really makes it especially just like inventively horrifying and crazy is that like she left behind extra body parts. Like, she left behind, like, it's not just the guy's body that she dismembered. She sprinkled in, you know, a tongue, an ear, and some extra fingers just to really like bring home that she's been torturing. She's got multiple victims that she's tortured and everything, and yeah, it's fucking wild.
It's she's got bodies. So there's some intense hallucinations going on around that, and
Aoma really starts to sort of lose his mind as he's forced to recognize that like this woman that he thought he loved, he didn't actually know at all, and he didn't actually understand who she really was. Just realizing that is enough to terrify him. It gets even crazier when he comes home to find Asami in his house.
Asami had snuck in previously and saw pictures of Aoyama with his deceased wife. And if you'll recall, she promised that she made a promise that he would love her and only her, and that right. is a flagrant violation of that promise.
Yes, yes. Having loved his wife in the past is too much of a transgression for her, and you know, it's unacceptable that he could have loved another woman at some point before they met. And you know, on top of that, he has a son that he loves, and that's also
fucked up.
Just entirely unacceptable to her. And it's one of these things where, you know, because we've gotten this backstory of this chain of traumas that have led Asami to be the person that she is, you come to recognize that, like, her desire for, like, total and complete love by another man is grounded in this, like, person who's been warped from a very young age. Like I say, there's a logic to it, even if it's a horrifying logic.
Absolutely. So, Asami, pissed off. He done fucked around with another woman.
Yeah.
Probably when she was a child.
Yeah.
So, she decides to drug his whiskey that he's constantly guzzling in this movie.
Yeah. And she gets him, and she perfectly paralyzes him, and she proceeds to torture him. And the torture sequence, as we said earlier, is like, you know, it's better than anything in any of the Saw movies or Hostel. Like, you know, no offense to those movies. I think, like, the first Saw especially is, like, a fucking awesome movie. But, like, nothing compares to just, like, watching this woman who, like, we've learned so much about and we've seen so much of, like, how depraved she really is. And, you know, now we watch her turn her full force directly on Aoyama. And, like, yeah, the scene with the needles, the her chanting deeper, deeper, deeper.
Kitty.
It's so good. It's just like, it's the best, worst thing I've ever seen. Like, it's so upsetting how she just takes this, like, manic delight in torturing him with needles. And it's disgusting and upsetting, but you also just sort of, there is that, like, great feeling that comes at the end of a great horror film where, like, you're sort of, you know, disgusted and repulsed, and but also, like, can't look away, and there's some sick satisfaction that comes out of watching all of this stuff culminate in such a, like, brutal and extreme form.
There is a brief flashback back to the bag.
Yeah, we finally get some backstory on the bag, and yeah, the full nature of that, and it turns out it's another guy that she's been holding hostage for who knows how long. Who is the guy?
So I posed this question on Twitter if anybody mm-hmm. wanted to hear us talk about any particular part of this, and I had a follower ask, "Who is the guy in the bag?" So I couldn't remember exactly.
Yeah, it sucks.
I found it.
You did find it.
Yes.
Awesome. Who is it?
So do you remember she was discussing in her audition that she had a deal with a DJ/music producer, but he
yes.
was untrustworthy?
Yes.
That's the man in the bag.
Yes. And she's cut his tongue out. She's cut his fingers off. That's what she sprinkled around the bar. She fucking, God, the bit where she pukes in the bowl and makes him eat it is just fucking unbelievable. Like, it's just
there's two parts to that. Number one yeah. is that according to Takashi Miike, his actor that played Asami, he said that she was a total method actor. She actually, like, vomed in a bowl.
Oh my God, that's amazing. Oh, that's so fucked up.
And number two, in that scene, the man crawling out of the bag just, like, consumes that vom like it's manna yeah. from the gods.
It's so rough. Like, it really is. Like, she's just, like, taken this man and destroyed him in a way where, like, you know, killing him would have been the nicer thing than what's happening on screen. Like what we see there is she's, you know, keeping this man as a pet in a sack. She literally, like, you watch her revert to being a physical child for a second and petting him like a dog.
So fucked up.
It's so, like, it's so beyond anything that you would, like, it's, you know, it's beyond like cartoonish anime violence. It's beyond like fucking you know, the worst kind of torture porn. It's just like such a deeply psychologically warped thing to make us all witness. And like I say, it's one of those moments that comes with great horror where like you kind of just can't unsee it once you've seen it.
Yeah, I mean, don't like eat clam chowder while you're watching this movie. We get back to Ayama, who is you know, just laying there, cannot move. They invented, you know, a special poison for this movie that, you know, renders you immobile, but also somehow keeps all of your nerves totally heightened.
Right. So you can feel everything. Yeah. Yeah. And the facial acting that Ayama is doing in that scene is just like fucking wild. Like watching his face be totally frozen, but at the same time his eyes just like bulge and everything like that is just fucking nuts. It's somehow worse than if, you know, he was like screaming and writhing in agony and everything. It's you know, that like inability to move makes it all the worse.
As you watch needles go into his eyes.
Yeah.
I had to have eye surgery when years ago.
Yeah.
And it was a kind of a minor thing, so I didn't go under for it. Instead they gave me one of those eyeball clamps.
Sure.
That keeps your eyes open. And so I got to watch as a doctor took a syringe and injected it into my tear duct.
Oh yeah.
And he told me, this, you're going to feel a sting followed by a strong burning sensation. He was correct. And so after that, I was numb and I just had to watch a scalpel go over my eye repeatedly for a while.
Oh my God. Yeah. And it's, like I say, this movie really tests your ability to trust relative strangers. And that's one of those moments where I think I definitely would have had an intense flashback to audition and would have had to really work to keep myself seated.
Well, it worked out okay though, because I was running late for a test. I had a class and a test in that class that day, and also homework due. And I didn't study. I didn't do my homework or anything. But I walked in, just my eye pouring blood. I'm like, hey, I don't have anything for class today. Can I just do it later? They're like, yes, leave, please.
Yeah. That's so funny. That rules. I don't quite know where to come back from that, other than to say that, like, from there, like, the moment that just like really makes this movie peak for me and makes it like one of my all-time favorite horror films is when she pulls out the wire saw and takes his foot off, because like that really is that like transcendent moment in horror where like things become so absurd and so over the top that like you can't help but laugh.
Absolutely. You have a 95-pound woman just working a wire saw to death so you can finally chomp through enough muscle and bone to take the foot off a grown man.
Yeah. It's just like it's such an insane thing to witness. Like your brain literally can't process it. And so when she like gets the foot off and fucking tosses it at the glass door and it bounces off, like, that's the funniest fucking thing I've ever seen. Like, I remember, like, I saw this in a pretty packed theater back in, like, February or March. And, like, the laughter that rolled through the audience was amazing. Because, like, some people were laughing, like, as soon as the foot starts to get thrown. Other people, it's like it took them just a few seconds until the foot had, like, fully bounced off the door to, like, register what had happened. And then they also laugh. It's just like it's just one of those things that like truly makes your brain short circuit, and like you just kind of almost can't believe what you've seen. And it's unbelievable that they fucking went there.
So he gets the she gets the foot off and gives us a nice solid bonk as it hits the door.
Yeah.
At that point, it's this is where Aoyama's son comes home, and because I think he was supposed to be out that day with a friend,
right,
but had to come home unexpectedly, as all good plots involve.
Right. Well, they're really, like, it's one of these things where, like, since I've seen this movie, I've kind of, like, gone over in my mind, like, other ways it could have ended. And in a lot of ways, like, this is the only way you could end it, is with the son suddenly turning back up and saving his dad, so his dad at least doesn't get kidnapped and put into a bag.
You do have a brief breakaway to what could have been, because Aoyama passes out, I assume, from, you know, massive shock. Blood loss.
yeah.
And he wakes up, and he's in bed with Asami.
Right.
And he proposes to her. This is at the seaside resort, and she accepts.
Right.
And he falls back asleep.
You get to see the you know, blissful fantasy of what could have been. You get one last reminder of, like, that's the ending to the romantic comedy. You know, like, that's the nice ending where, you know, everybody rides off into the sunset. But that is not the ending that Audition gives us, and it's all the better for it. When I initially saw the movie, I came out of it and I was like, I don't know how I feel about this. Like, well, you know, oh, we slip into a dream and maybe the dream was what actually happened. And maybe this has all just been, you know, a crazy nightmare of him imagining all this other stuff with Asami. But, like, I think the movie ends pretty definitively saying, like, oh no, motherfucker got his foot cut off. Like, it really happened. And I think by teasing that possibility of what could have been, the movie really does, like, make what actually does happen all the more horrifying. Like, it reminds you of, like, the pursuit of this, you know, sweet romantic ideal that's just been completely obliterated.
Definitely. Because you have the ending that could have been, and then smash cut to him waking up, bleeding from his missing foot socket.
Yeah.
And seeing his son fighting Asami, who has a fucking mace.
it's this perfect thing of, like, of course she has a mace. Like, obviously, like, this woman has a mace in her bag, just ready to roll. Like,
why would she not?
It's just like in the already batshit logic of this movie, her having the mace is just, like, fucking perfect. And by just sheer accident, he manages to kick her down the stairs. And it's, again, this sort of, like, comedically absurd moment where, like, all of this violence, all this insanity just comes to an abrupt, shocking end. And it's, there's no rhyme or reason for it. There's no sort of, you know, justifiable heroic moment. It's just sort of in a fit of terror, Aoyama's son managed to succeed, by sheer accident.
And looking at her laying at the bottom of the stairs, you know, with a broken neck, slowly fading from consciousness, every part of my mind is, like, screaming, double tap, double tap.
It's, you know, it is this thing where you want it to end so badly. You want a definitive, brutal finale, so that we can put this all to a rest and all that. And, you know, she does die. But it's obvious that Aoyama's, like, never gonna be the same again. There is no real recovering from this experience, even if he survived.
It seems unlikely that he would survive, but I don't know. We can suspend our belief about, you know, if she cut through a major artery or not.
It's, you know, maybe he did bleed out. The movie is very ambiguous about that in the very ending. Like I say, the thing that really just makes the movie so fucking fascinating is how it flips the gender roles of, you know, slasher movies. So effectively, you know, you don't have, like, a psychopath man with a chainsaw chasing a woman who, you know, inadvertently figures out how to kill the psychopath at the very end. You know, it's this psychopathic woman who we deeply understand why she is so traumatized, why she does what she does, but also the man she's torturing, does he deserve what happens to him? Probably not really, but at the same time, like, when you take this, like, bizarre, like, there's just this like moment that you can't deny of satisfaction of seeing that foot pop off. Like, it's so absurd. It's so over the top. And yet there's some like sick part of yourself that's like, that like wants to cheer when you see this like insane violence happen. And you have to start to question yourself about why that is, why you on a certain level kind of like seeing Aoyama punished for his like silly stunt that he pulled.
He definitely deserves some kind of punishment, but I think it's the same thing with a lot of the audience reactions to like Midsommar.
Right.
It's, you know, you clearly have somebody that was in the wrong, but do they deserve just this horrific end? Maybe.
Yeah. Yeah. It's one of these things where like, you know, intellectually you can sort of distance yourself and say like, oh no, that's horrible. There's no justification for this level of violence that's rendered on this like dirtbag man. But on a like emotional level, you sort of get it and you sort of identify. And yeah, I'm super glad you brought up Midsommar, because Midsommar is very, very similar to Audition in terms of the themes of, you know, gender and what it really means for a relationship to turn sour. Yeah, it's funny because like I don't think people would necessarily connect the two movies in terms of their aesthetics, but in terms of their themes, to me, they're almost identical.
We're definitely not going to talk about Midsommar on this spooktacular series, but I am highly recommending that everybody go out and see it.
It's incredible.
It's so good.
I have plans every once in a while when a really great movie like this comes out. I like to like take all the footage from the film and recut it to a song, and I really want to recut Midsommar to Generation by Liturgy.
Oh, hell yeah.
Yeah, and just like, because I think like the whole energy of that song and that whole album, Aesthetica, really matches Midsommar perfectly. And like, I'm really excited to try to dig into that when I get some downtime later this year. Because like, yeah, like you want to talk about the link between heavy metal and horror. Like to me, like a lot of the same just like raw feelings that come up listening to certain metal songs perfectly match the feelings that come up to watching horror films. It's so funny to me that Audition came out in the late 90s, because like so much of the like images in this movie feel like images that could be in like a fucking Marilyn Manson video, in a Korn video, a Slipknot video. Like the images of the telephone and the guy in the sack and everything like that, like all that shit feels like it could have been sprinkled into any of those like late 90s, early 2000s metal bands.
Absolutely. Yeah. The image of Asami in a black lab coat, leather lab coat, rather.
Yeah.
That easily fits in with like a Static X video.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. It's so funny how like, I don't know how much like Mike was like aware of that stuff, but it just sort of perfectly matches the aesthetics of that time period in a way that's just, I think is really fucking impressive.
Overall, what were our feelings on Audition?
I mean, like I said, it is, as far as I'm concerned, it's up there with The Thing and Alien as like one of the greatest horror movies I've ever fucking seen. I have been obsessed with it ever since I saw it and can't stop thinking about what a fucking perfect wild ride it is. If you're somebody who loves horror, I don't know how it's not at the top of your list.
There you have it, folks. Top of the barrel, man. You gotta watch it. Yeah. If you haven't watched it already, why did you just listen to a spoiler for you?
That's entirely true. But I mean, hopefully this discussion gave some perspective and all that good stuff.
Absolutely. Before we go, Carter, if folks want to keep up with what you're doing, what should they do?
If you want to follow me on Twitter, I'm at Carter D Moon on Twitter. I tweet out all my podcasts from there. I'm going to be starting a new podcast very soon called Big Booking. That's going to be coming out in November. Keep an eye on my Twitter, cause I'll be promoting that on there. I'm very excited to watch that show. So yeah, that's where I'm at.
Do the things, folks. And, cheers. We'll see you next time.
Yeah.
Giddy, 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 giddy.
disappeared completely, and no trace of her can ever be found again. I've destroyed her with acid. How can you prove an identity without a body?
Listening to 66.6 FM, Radio TOVH, The Flush.